with term coming up next week, it's time for us to confirm, get ourselves in the mood. We should have begun last week, but last week we couldn't have class based on the weather and other considerations, so we'll start this week. I passed out sheets. You know, in past years, we've gone through different chapters of the Megillah. We're actually up to chapter 8 this year. For those who did not hear the previous classes, they're available online. For those who are here, hopefully you're somewhat aware of what we discussed in previous years, even though it's been a long time. But before we get to the Megillah, I just want to give a little bit of introduction, I guess, to Purim and to the season that we're in. Now, as is with every single holiday, can you hear the door? Thank you. As is every holiday, but especially Purim, now what you put into preparing for the holiday really is how much you get out of the holiday. If you just kind of enter into a Yom Tov without thinking about it beforehand, understanding what it's about, getting ready for it, so then the Yom Tov passes over you just as quick as you enter into it without thinking. If you prepare yourself beforehand, and you think about the concepts, the ideas, the obligations, the meaning, the story, the lessons, everything else that goes with it, so then you'll see that your Yom Tov is a totally different experience, because as you're observing the Yom Tov and celebrating it, you actually understand and feel all the different concepts which you're supposed to feel in the Yom Tov. I think with Purim especially, we have this issue, because Purim, in a way, is a day which can become, I'd say people call it more of a children's type holiday, a little bit too lightheaded, a little bit too, a little bit too out there. But yet, a lot of us miss the spiritual point of Purim, and the ability to tap into Purim in a real deep spiritual level. And when it comes to Purim especially, Purim is regarded as one of the holiest days of the year, but yet it's been reduced by many to a holiday which seems to be just, you know, for the kids to dress up and eat candy and just to have a good time. But we miss the spiritual element of it. So especially for Purim, which is such a special holy holiday, which is in a certain sense misunderstood, I think it's especially important to put extra time and thought into it beforehand in order to get ourselves ready for the day. I pointed out before that, you know, when we enter into the month of Adar, the month we're in right now, so the rabbis teach us, when Adar begins, you increase your happiness. The word v'simcha in Hebrew, you can rearrange the letters as machshava, as thought, because thought brings joy. When we talk about having joy, we don't mean, you know, the craziness of Purim. We don't mean the dancing and the singing. That's an expression of joy. But true joy comes through thought, the thought which you put into it beforehand. When you think about the concepts of any holiday, especially Purim, you think about how God saved us, what's the lessons in the Megillah, what are we supposed to think about on Purim itself, and you get yourself in the mood, in thought, so then when the day comes, there's a true joy expressed based on the day. But if you don't think about it beforehand, if there's no machshava, then there's no besimcha, because the besimcha you have will be a superficial simcha. It'll just be just the smiles and dancing and the candy and anything else you might participate in on Purim, but it won't be something coming from the depths of understanding the day. So it's really important to put ourselves into understanding what Purim is all about prior to Purim beginning. So that's one point of introduction. Then the second point of introduction is what I share. I try to share this every single year, but it's important. Is what is our perspective on the Megillah overall? The Megillah's Esther is one of the books of the Tanakh, the latest book of the Tanakh, the one that was, you know, accepted last as part of the canon. It's a book which Esther had to fight for the rabbis to accept as a holy writing. Now, Esther wrote it down, and the Gemara records that Esther had to go back and forth in, you know, disputing with the rest of Mordechai, disputing with the sages of the time, shall this be accepted into the Tanakh? Eventually, Esther and Mordechai prevailed and was accepted into Tanakh. But what is our perspective on the Megillah overall? So the Vilna Gaon points out in the beginning of his commentary on the Megillah, how we're supposed to view the entire story of the Megillah. It's a famous concept, but it's, you know, worth repeating every single year. Purim is the holiday which marks the idea of a hidden miracle. When you read the story of Purim, when you read the Megillah, God's name is not mentioned in the Megillah anywhere. Not a single time. It doesn't mention the word God. No reference to God at all in the Megillah. You don't see anything which we would call miraculous. There's no sea splitting. There's no plagues. No lightning strikes Haman from the sky. I mean, everything seems to be totally natural. Everything just seems to be just kind of run-of-the-mill events, coincidences, which all come together to create a tremendous salvation for the Jewish people. But the Vilna Gaon points out that that's the whole purpose of this book, is to teach us that God works in hidden ways. And the idea of a hidden miracle is that it is a miracle. It wasn't just natural events which happened to result in a great victory, but it was miraculous events that were guided by God every step of the way, yet you couldn't tell. Throughout the entire Megillah, if you were standing there in Persia, in the city of Shushan, watching the events, you would, as a Jew, you'd be terrified. You would never have seen any sort of salvation coming your way until after the fact. Once you see Haman hanging on the gallows, once you see Mordechai being led around, you know, on the royal horse, wearing the royal garments, at that point, you realize, well, something very interesting happened here. Maybe God's on our side. But until that point, all you saw was doom and destruction, and you don't see any miracle, anything about God. And after the story, you have to go back and trace the events and figure out what was the miracle, how did it happen? What here was miraculous? And no single event was miraculous. What was miraculous was the entire picture. When you put the picture all together, then the events are miraculous. So when you read the Megillah, and this is the point made by the Vilna Gaon, when you read the Megillah, our goal is to show, the Megillah's goal is to show us, the Megillah happens over a course of 12 years. But yet, you know, we cut out a lot of those years. We only see a few specific events. Because when they wrote down the Megillah, they were trying to show us which events were part of the miraculous events. Which of these events were part of the divine intervention. So the stories that are told in the Megillah, more of a 9-year story, but those stories told in the Megillah, those stories are the ones which Mordechai and Esther pinpointed as being, these are the miraculous events which occurred. And everything else was cut away because those weren't the miracles. So as we read the Megillah, our job is to see, why is each and every verse part of the miracle? How do we see God working in His hidden and mysterious ways in this verse, in that verse, in this story, in that story? And after when you read the Megillah and understand the story and how it all weaves together, I mean, it's a beautiful tapestry of divine intervention. But you just couldn't tell that every step of the way. So whenever you look at the Megillah, no matter what chapter you're learning, the point is to understand that these are all miraculous events guided by God, no less miraculous than the Exodus or the splitting of the sea. It just was done behind the scenes rather than up front. The name Esther itself comes from the word Hester, Soser, which means being hidden. Esther is somebody, her name denotes hidden, the miracles of Purim were hidden, and Megillas Esther, the word Megillah also can be read as Megala, to reveal. Esther is hidden. It's to reveal the hidden. That sometimes you have to reveal the hidden hand of God. We don't always see how God functions in this world. But sometimes after the fact, you can look back and see, well, God was the one intervening here. These are all miracles of God, which we didn't see at the time. But after the fact, we can reveal what happened. So that is the perspective of the book of Esther. And that, you can understand, was maybe why the rabbis weren't so sure if they should accept it into Tanakh. Because Esther had to prove to them that, you know, these events really were Tanakh worthy. There actually were divine, miraculous events, because it wasn't clear. Esther had to prove herself, based on different verses in the Torah, that this miracle was actually predicted by the Torah itself, that we were expecting this to happen. And once Esther was able to prove that, the rabbi said, okay, now we understand these are actually miraculous events of God that deserve being in the Tanakh itself. But it wasn't clear that these events were miraculous in any way until you look at the whole story together and figure out that this is actually God working behind the scenes to bring a tremendous salvation to people. And to take the miracle very simply, I mean, obviously there's a lot of elaborate details here, but it's always good to put things into like modern perspectives in ways we can relate to. My teacher, Rabbi Lubyansky, he once said that you can view Purim as the Holocaust that didn't happen. I mean, we know what the Holocaust was, and we know the tragedy of millions and millions of Jews, you know, hundreds of communities being wiped off the face of the earth. And you know, that happened, you know, very near, you know, very, very close to us. And we all know people and relate to people who experienced that. Megillas Esther would have been another Holocaust. Ahasuerus ruled the entire world, just about. He was the emperor over 127 provinces. He was somebody who had in his power to exterminate every single Jew alive, more or less. And it was going to happen. And it was set. And it was slated. And the letters were sent out. Everything was ready to go. And by some strange course of events, he happened to have chosen this orphan girl to be his queen, and she was able somehow to reverse the decree. It's as if it was, you know, Hitler happened to have a wife who he didn't realize was actually, you know, the daughter of a rabbi, you know? And then only right before he was about to begin the war, suddenly his wife turns to him and says, you know, this is actually my people. We can't imagine what that would be like, you know? But that's what happened in the story. That's exactly what it was. And it's something which, you know, the magnitude of that miracle we miss sometimes. But it would have been another Holocaust. It would have been just, you know, exactly like the Holocaust. And at the last moment, based on the hand of God, we were able to reverse the decree. So that's just to give it the broad perspective, I think, on purpose. It's important to understand. So we left off, the last time we said Megillah, we left off after chapter 7 and chapter 8. So let's go to chapter 8 and we'll go from there. As it is in every book of Tanakh, you know, there's many, many commentaries written on the Megillah. What we'll do is I'm kind of give you my running commentary based on the primary commentaries that I've studied, and we'll try to draw out some lessons of every single verse, an event that we see in the Megillah. So let's start, we're in chapter 8. I guess to bring us up to date in the Megillah, where we are at this point in the story, so we're jumping in the middle right now. So, you know, Esther was the queen. She had fasted for 3 days, being aware of the decree to exterminate the Jews. She had her first party with King Ahasuerus and invited Haman to the party. At that first party, she did not divulge what her purpose was in creating the party. She did not make her request to Ahasuerus. That very night was the night where Ahasuerus had trouble sleeping and he wanted to reward Mordechai. The next day, Haman leads around Mordechai on the horse, and Haman has to give him great reward. That next day, they had the second party, and that's where Esther accused Haman of wanting to exterminate her people. At that point, Ahasuerus had Haman killed on the spot. And in the 7th chapter of the Megillah is when we see that everything, that was in the 7th chapter, is when we see that Haman is killed and hanged on the gallows that were intended for Mordechai. And that's where the story left off last time we studied this together. So the beginning of chapter 8 is the verse right after Haman is killed, and it says that the king's anger had left him. He had calmed down. He was no longer angry. So let's begin. We'll begin with the first pasuk, verse 1, and we'll just kind of go through there and try to discuss different ideas of the Megillah. So at this point now, even though Haman is killed, but the decree to exterminate the Jews is still there. I mean, that decree was sent out to the entire kingdom, and as we'll see, a decree which was made with the signet ring of the king could not have been rescinded, to figure out why that is, but he could not rescind that decree. So now Esther hasn't finished all of her work quite yet, because she had Haman killed, but she still has to save her people. So she sees Ahasuerus is now on her side, and she sees the hand of God at work, so she's ready to make her full request. But yet, we still have a lot of work to do here. So in verse 1 it says, on that day, the day that Haman was killed, did the king Ahasuerus give the house of Haman, the Jews' enemy, unto Esther the queen? Again, I don't take responsibility for the translation here. I've downloaded it from a place online, but you know, we'll do our best. We can always refer back to the Hebrew if we need to. And Mordechai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. So verse 1, we have Ahasuerus gives all of the wealth and the household of Haman to Esther. And Haman, you know, the verse stresses, Haman was the enemy of the Jews. The Jews, you know, are our archenemy. He's the one who wanted to eliminate every single one of us. And on that day, everything became flipped around. And his wealth, his estate was given over to Esther. So in my mind, this verse highlights a very important part of the story. You know, the theme of the Purim story is what we call as V'nahafochu. Everything was reversed. That's the song everyone sings, V'nahafochu. That's a big song. Everyone sings about Purim. And the idea of V'nahafochu, that it was totally reversed, is that it wasn't just that, you know, there was a decree against us and we overcame it. There's a battle and we won. But everything that Haman attempted to do flipped right back at him. An analogy given is if you take a ball and throw it at a wall, the harder you throw it at the wall, the harder it bounces back at you. So every single action that Haman took to exterminate the Jews, everything was flipped right back around. So you have here his estate, all the wealth he had acquired throughout his lifetime, his house, his money. He was ready to use that money, and he was willing to pay to kill the Jews. We saw earlier in the Megillah, he offered a lot of money to Ahasuerus to give him permission to kill the Jews. Ahasuerus refused the money, but Haman was willing to spend all this money to kill the Jews. And now, a few days later, what happens? All of that money ends up in the Jews' hands. It's an incredible thing. All goes to his archenemy. Now, how do they use this money? When Esther and Mordechai were able to take the money from Haman, where did this money go? So I found an interesting quote from a Medrash, essentially, that says that one-third of the money Mordechai and Esther kept, one-third of the money was given to those who spent their time studying Torah, and then one-third of the money was used in the building of the second temple, second base of Mikdash. So based on that, it's an incredible thing. What helped us build the second temple? It was Haman's money. Now, the Purim story happens in between the two temples. This is the 70-year exile between the two temples. And Haman's money itself was used to build the second base of Mikdash. It's an incredible thing. The irony of it, that Haman's money goes to support Torah scholars and to build the temple and give it to Mordechai and Esther, it's a tremendous irony. Now we talk about the idea of jokes on Purim, the Purim joke. So these are the Purim jokes. The Purim jokes are the irony of the story. Haman is the big Purim joke, that everything he tries to do flips right back at him. I also find it amazing, I'll add at this point, that Haman attempted essentially to destroy the world, because destroying the Jewish people is what's going will destroy the purpose of this world. You know, the world was created so that we can bring the message of God to the world. Haman's goal was totally annihilate the Jewish people, which essentially is going to delete from the creation this message of bringing the one and only God into the world. But yet, Haman, who wanted to destroy the world, his money was taken to build what we call build the world. It says in Pirkei Avos, what are the three pillars of this world? The Torah, the service of God, Avodah, and Chesed, kindness. Those are the three pillars. So when the Medrash tells us that the money is split into thirds, one third goes to the building of the temple, that's the service of God. One third goes to those who study Torah, that's the Torah, that's the pillar of Torah. And one third goes to Mordechai and Esther, who are the ones who had to care for the people, they're the ones who did the Chesed. So it's incredible that Haman's money, which he wanted to use to destroy the world, is being used now to build the pillars of the world. I find it an amazing irony. And this concept overall is based on a larger concept, broader concept that the rabbis teach us, which is the relationship between the Jewish people and an Amalek, or if you take it back, between Yaakov and Esav. You know, Haman descends from Amalek. He's Haman HaAgagi, King Agag. King Agag was the king of Amalek. Amalek is a nation which is the opposite, stands for the opposite of what the Jewish people stand for. We stand for bringing the name of the one only God to the world, and they're here in order to foil our mission, essentially. They are the antithesis of what we stand for. The rabbis teach us, you know, that Amalek descends from Esav. That's clear in the Torah, that Amalek is the grandson of Esav, and we obviously come from Yaakov. Yaakov and Esav are the two brothers. So the rabbis teach us that Yaakov and Esav have this, I think, called inverse relationship. When Yaakov succeeds, Esav fails. Esav succeeds, Yaakov fails. Haman and Mordechai and Esther are just kind of a miniature of that model. As Haman is ascending to power, the Jews are descending down into the dumps. As Haman is killed, the Jews ascend up into power once again. And this is very, very clear from the fact that all of Haman's estate is then given over to the Jews. Haman works so hard, as he's ascending to power, ascending to wealth, he works so hard to become great. And as he falls down into the dumps, we then rise up and take all that he has. So that's this concept of Nahafochu, this reversal is that concept. And this really dates back to Yaakov and Esav. And this is considered a truth throughout history, that when the Jews are up, the descendants of Esav are down. And when the descendants of Esav are up, the Jews are down. Just by the way, that's usually applied. You know, the Roman society, the Roman Empire, was also attributed to Esav. And as Rome ascended to power, then we also were destroyed. They destroyed the Second Temple. And this concept is applied throughout many parts of Jewish history. So that is the what you see in the first verse here in chapter 8. But it's a very important concept. It's a central concept to Purim and to history, which is that there is this inverse relationship between the Jews and Amalek, between Haman and Mordechai and Esther. And we see that as Haman tries so hard to exterminate the Jews, everything he does comes flip back right back in his face. Let's see the then the verse then says that now Mordechai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was unto her. Until this point, Achashverosh was not aware of their relationship. I mean, Achashverosh knew that Esther was brought up in his house. That's clear. I mean, she was brought up as an orphan girl in Mordechai's house. He didn't know that they were a family. He didn't know she was Jewish. He thought, okay, Mordechai found a girl on the street, needed help, and he helped her out. Mordechai was a very, very kind and righteous person, and he helped to raise orphans. And that's about all he knew. At this point, Esther revealed to Achashverosh the relationship she had with Mordechai. So now Mordechai comes before the king. So it's pointed out that Mordechai, until this point, even Mordechai was led around the previous day, like that's that morning. That morning, Mordechai was led around on a horse, and he was given that great honor by Haman, that he's somebody the king wants to honor. Mordechai at that point went back to his repentance. Mordechai was spending his time fasting, wearing sackcloth and ashes, repenting in prayer, because he saw the tremendous fate the Jews were about to endure, you know, the decree for extermination. And he had gone right back to his fasting and repentance right after he was led around by Haman. But now that Esther revealed the relationship, but only at that point did Mordechai come before the king. And now they know, now we know, now Achashverosh knows who Mordechai was. Let's go to verse 2. And the king took off his ring. which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordechai. And Esther set Mordechai over the house of Haman. So now we see another reversal. Earlier in the story, when Haman comes to the king for permission to kill the Jews, the king takes off his signet ring and gives it to Haman. So do whatever you want. The power is yours. Take my ring, seal any decree you'd like. Anything you like is yours. When they killed Haman, he took his ring back. And now he gives it over to Mordechai. So it's another reversal of Haman's scheme. That's very clear. But just furthermore, I had a point. The Gemara tells us a very interesting comparison. The Gemara says that the giving over of the ring to Haman was much more powerful to the Jewish people than the 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses, I guess is the word, 7 female prophets, which arose and rebuked the Jewish people. Meaning that we have prophecy throughout the whole Tanakh as the prophets. And there are 48 male prophets and female prophets which spoke to us and tried to bring us back to the right path. They gave us Musar, Tochcha, gave us rebuke. They were able to try to drive us back towards Hashem and doing the right things. And essentially they failed because we kept doing our sins and it led us into exile, led us into destruction. So the prophets tried so hard, but it didn't really impact us in a very powerful way. But yet when we saw Achashverosh give that ring to Haman, the Gemara tells us that was a much more powerful event than all of the prophets which ever rose and rebuked the Jewish people. So what's the idea? It's that prophets are giving you theory. They're telling you this is what will happen, this could happen, this is what God says. It's intellectual thoughts, it's speeches, it's lectures, it's different points. But when you see it in action, when you see a ring on Haman's finger, that's terrifying. That's much scarier than a prophet coming and rebuking you. Because the prophet rebukes you, it's all conceptual. This is reality. So when the Jews saw that ring on Haman's finger, that's what really drove them to repentance. That was a very powerful scene for the Jews. Now, this is the opposite. When they saw the ring on Mordechai's finger, imagine how they felt. Imagine how empowering it was. Imagine how proud they felt that Mordechai now had that ring upon his finger. So this is a very powerful event for the Jews to see as Mordechai takes the ring of Haman, and now Mordechai has the power. Let's see verse 3. But Esther spoke yet again before the king, and fell down on his feet, and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite, and his device that he had devised against the Jews. So Esther now has to request for the nation, because as we said, even though Haman's dead, there's still a decree out there. And at this point, all the enemies of the Jews are still going to rise up and kill them, and the Jews have no protection. So Esther now the king never responded to Esther's request to save the people. So she still has to beseech the king for help in saving the Jewish people. Verse 4, when the king held out to Esther the golden scepter, so Esther arose and stood before the king. So commentaries point out that this wasn't a one-time event. She had to keep going back to the king again and again and again in order to save the people. And stretching out the scepter was the king's act of showing that he accepts her into his presence, like we find earlier in the Megillah in the story. But she kept coming back again, risking her life. As the Megillah says clearly, you can't go into the king without being called in. And she wasn't called in, but she kept going back and making these requests over and over again, risking her life for the Jews. He wanted the king to somehow change the decree against the Jewish people. And each time the king stretched out his scepter in order to accept her in. So in verse 5 she says, and she said, if it please the king, if I found favor in his sight, and the king seemed right before, and the thing seemed right before the king, and I'm pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman the son of Hamdasa the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews that are in the king's provinces. So now she makes the request that she wants to reverse that decree against the Jews. That's what you find in verse 5. The language of the Megillah is interesting. Esther says, to please the 4 things. Please the king, if I found favor in his sight, if the things seem right before the king, and I'll be pleasing in his eyes. It seems repetitive. Why does Esther have to say all these different phrases? What's going on here? So a lot of commentaries point this out, but I'll quote from the Malbim. The Malbim writes that when you make a request of somebody, for him to grant your request, one of 4 things has to be in place. Either the person making the request needs to find favor in the eyes of the person who has the power, or the request has to be worthy of being fulfilled. I mean, even if you don't like me, if my request makes sense, you'll do it. Those are 2 things we have to figure. Either that is the request a good request, or maybe the request is fine. Even though the request is not such a great request, the king likes it for some other reason. Is the requester a person the king likes? Or is he somebody at least he feels there'll be some advantage in granting his request? So Esther says these four things. She's trying to point out these four possibilities. I can find favor in his eyes. I mean, even though maybe my request is not so advantageous to the king, at least I'll find favor in his sight. Or the things seem right before the king. Maybe the request will seem like it's proper. Or actually pleasing in his eyes. Or if it please, I skipped one, please the king. But those four phrases are supposed to encompass these four ideas. Either the request has to either find favor or be advantageous, or the requester has to find favor or be advantageous. One of those four things has to fit for a request to be granted. The difference between being advantageous or finding favor, one could just be that even though I don't see exactly what redeemed from it, you know, it's a nice thing to do, so I'll do it. The other one is a more functional type of benefit, that I see there's a functional benefit to this, so I'm going to grant the request.
So the same thing twice.
No, because it's
Melech Tov, and second, the Bashar Adro, the Melech.
So no, so Imal Melech Tov and Kasher Adavar Lifnei Melech. Imal Tov is just that he likes the request, even though it may not be a big advantage. And Kasher Adavar Lifnei Melech is that it's actually an advantageous request. He has some benefit to get from it. And then Matzasi Chain is that if you like me, despite me not causing you any great advantage, but he's like me. Or Tova Ani Be'enav is that, you know, I am somebody who can bring you some sort of functional advantage. That's what he's saying. So that's verse 5. Let's go to verse 6. For how can I endure to see the evil that shall come unto my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So in verse 6, Esther is pointing out that I can't endure to see my people being destroyed. The Maharal points out on this verse, he says that when it comes to the people, I mean, this is kind of lost in, I guess you can say in the translation. In the translation it says, when it comes to people, you see the evil that shall come to the people. And then when it says her kindred, you know, I guess her family, it says the destruction of my kindred. So Mara points out that she didn't mention the destruction of the people. Because Esther knows that God would never destroy the people entirely. The Jewish people have a guarantee from God that they will exist. But there'll be evil to the Jews. Many Jews will be destroyed. And like we saw in the Holocaust, you know, probably, I don't know if it's a majority of Jews, but a huge number of Jews were destroyed in the Holocaust. But God would never destroy the entire people. So when it comes to the people, she said the evil that will befall my people. When it comes to her kindred, as it's translated, the Hebrew is molad etzi, I guess those from my home place, my home neighborhood, something like that. There's a destruction, because God will destroy certain patches of Jews. God would never destroy the entire people. In verse 7, the king Ahasuerus said unto Esther the queen, and to Mordechai the Jew, behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and him they have hanged upon the gallows, because he laid his hands upon the Jews. So, at this, let's read verse 8 also. Write ye, also concerning the Jews, as it liketh you. I don't know why the translation has to be so formal, but as you like in the king's name, and seal with the king's ring. For the writing which is written in the king's name, and seal with the king's ring, may no man reverse. So at this point, Ahasuerus first is saying that, I know, I already did a lot for you. I killed Haman, I gave you his estate. So he didn't want to just like say, okay, let's do what we can do. But at this point, he understands that there is a need to act further. So that's what he says in verse 8. But it's as if he's already trying to show Esther, I've done so much for you already, what else do you want out of me? And that's what it sounds like in verse 7. It's interesting that the Vilna Gaon points out that until now, the only one present talking was the queen, was Esther. And now, he's speaking to Mordechai as well. So the Vilna Gaon writes that Ahasuerus, in some ways, I don't know, was scared of Queen Esther. Not scared in the sense that she was doing anything to him, but scared that it was his wife. He didn't want to cause her pain. And he was worried if he just speaks to her, she's going to break down in tears again. He didn't want her to cry. Right? So he brought in Mordechai as well, so he can address both of them, so it wouldn't be as tough on Esther to handle the situation. But he tells her that it's already been sealed in the king's ring. Any writing in the king's ring cannot be reversed. The typical understanding of this was that it was some sort of law in the kingdom, some sort of constitutional law in Persia that as soon as the king makes a decree, that's it. It's permanent. It's interesting that Rashi points out that he says it wasn't a law in Persia that he couldn't take back a decree. But Rashi says that it would be embarrassing for the king to rescind a decree he made. To have to reverse a law which the king himself had decreed, it's an embarrassing thing for the king. It's shameful. So therefore, the king was allowed to, according to Rashi, he wouldn't rescind the decree. But I think most commentaries say that it was actually part of the laws of the Persian kingdom that you could not take back a decree. But this Rashi's understanding is very interesting. He was just embarrassed to do it. So that's in verse 8, we have trouble now. Because we can't take back the decree, so what are we going to do? But he says, you take my ring and you be creative, do whatever you can to save the Jews, but I can't just rescind the decree, it's too late to do that. So in verse 9, what happens? Then were the king of scribes called at that time the third month, which is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day thereof, and it was written according to all that Mordechai commanded concerning the Jews, even to the satraps, which is some sort of, I guess, governor or official. And the governors and princes of the provinces, which are from India to Ethiopia, which again, those translations could be accurate, necessarily, what those countries were, 127 provinces, until every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, and to the Jews according to their writing and according to their language. So let's understand what's happening here. So at this point, you know, Mordechai calls in the scribes, and he's writing out new letters. He has the king's signet ring, he can write whatever he wants, he needs to do something to save the Jews. So he calls in the scribes to write these letters. Now if you look at the time frame, it's kind of surprising. He calls them in on the 23rd of Sivan. Now to put the Purim story in perspective, a lot of people don't think about this, the Purim story actually occurred on Pesach. It says that Haman drew his lots in the month of Nisan. Pesach, the 15th of Nisan. When Esther and Mordechai fasted, so the rabbis teach us they actually fasted during the Seder. They didn't eat the matzah that year. They fasted over the Seder, over the, day, the first day of Pesach, but then they had their three-day fast. Now the decree to kill them was going to be in Adar. But Haman made his decree. I mean, Haman made his decree for 12 months later. He was in Nisan. And he said, in 12 months from now, in Adar, I'm going to kill the Jews. But the whole Purim story occurred over Pesach. It's a fascinating thing. I believe if you look at the end of the Haggadah, on Seder night, the first night, there's a piyut, a poem in the Haggadah about what happened b'chatzilah, what happened at midnight of Seder night. And it mentions there that Achashverosh, you know, and I forgot the actual wording of the poem, but it mentions the Purim story happening on that night as well. So it's an interesting thing. But if you think about it, it's very strange, because this whole story transpired in the month of Nisan on Pesach. There are actually some Jews who have a custom to make a festive meal to celebrate the death of Haman on Pesach. Right? I think a lot of Hasidim, certain Jews actually make a festive meal for Haman's Yortzei. And they'll celebrate Haman's death on Pesach. There's a custom like that. But if Mordechai was trying to save the Jews, why did he wait 3 months? 2 months, I guess. I mean, if Nisan's the first month, he waited another 2 months in order to send the letters back out. I mean, you would think he would act as soon as he can. I mean, they're still subject to annihilation. You wouldn't think Mordechai would be sending something out the next day. Why did he only call in the scribes 2 months later? It's a very surprising thing. So the Vilna Gaon points out on this. He says that Mordechai wanted to be sure his message was accepted. So what would happen? If he sent out a messenger a day or two later, it wouldn't have been the same messengers that brought the first letters. So people are going to be sitting somewhere in their country, somewhere under the kingdom and empire of Persia, and they received yesterday a letter that said, kill the Jews. And then today they'll receive a letter that says, save the Jews. So people will say there's a fraud happening. Something's wrong here. These are counterfeit. Because we got a letter yesterday from the king saying, kill the Jews. It doesn't make sense that today we're going to letter to save the Jews. So how can we address that problem? He waited for the messengers to come back to Shushan. He sent out the second letter of the same exact messengers. That's what the Vilna Gaon says. So the same messengers bring you two different letters. The messenger you trust, that this is not a fraud, the decree is actually going to be changed. That's what you would assume. So that's why he waited 2 months to do this, in order so the messengers could travel around the kingdom and come back again. And these poor guys were ready to go back to their families, and he says, sorry, back to the road. That's what he told them. But it was the same messengers delivering the second letters that delivered the first letters. So that's what the Vilna Gaon writes. Also, some point out that it gave the Jews 70 additional days to repent. We know the Jews were in exile after the destruction of the first temple. They had 70 years of exile in Babylonia and Persia. And for those 70 years, they had 70 days at this point in the story to repent one day for each year that they had sinned in exile. So there's 70 days in between the decree and new letters going out, because Mordechai was, I guess, encouraging more teshuva, more repentance, so that God would be on our side in a more powerful way. But it does say, we'll see it in the next verse, in verse 10. Where do we see it? Verse verse 14. Verse 14, when the messengers actually go out, it says that they hastened and were pressed on by the king's commandment, meaning they rushed out to deliver these letters. Because once it was time to deliver the letters, Mordechai said, get to it right away. You know, we can't delay anymore. So he waited 2 months in order to avoid the fraud, the Vilna Gaon says. But once it came time to actually send the letters out, he rushed these messengers right back on the road once again. To get out of here right away. And it's pointed out because for the Jews, they wanted to see this thing taken care of. They were still very scared. You know, as joyous as it was, and as confident as they were that Mordechai Esther could save them now, and saw God's hand at work. But, you know, they still were kind of nervous. So Mordechai, as soon as he saw the time was right, he sent the messengers as fast as they could in order to deliver the letters. So what did he write exactly? What did he write exactly? So it says, let's read verse 10, verse 11. And they wrote the name of the king, Achashverosh, and they sealed it with the king's ring, and they sent letters by post, on horseback, riding on swift steeds, and were used in the king's service, bread of the stud. I don't understand, right? This is kind of a side note, but the Hebrew term, the end of this pasuk, it says, A'achashtranim b'nei haram lachim. And the Talmud says that we don't know how to translate those words. So I'm not sure how this translator knows how to translate the words. This is my own personal question. They translate it as bread of the stud. But the Talmud says these words we don't know how to translate. The Talmud, in discussing, are you allowed to read the Megillah in other languages, it, you know, goes through different opinions on that. But it says that there are some terms in the Megillah that can't be translated because we don't know how to translate those words. So, but this translator somehow had a translation of bread of the stud. I don't know. But let's see verse 11. It says that the king had granted the Jews that were in every city to gather themselves together and to stand for their life, to destroy and to slay and to cause to perish all the forces of the people and province that would assault them, their little ones and women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So he writes out in these letters that the Jews are granted the power to defend themselves. Which is interesting, but that actually, I mean, the Jews probably defend themselves anyways. I don't know why they did the kings, you know, what was the advantage of this exactly?
I was wondering, it's not just that they can defend themselves, which we would expect them to defend themselves.
Right.
But whoever they kill and whatever spoil they take, they're allowed to keep legally.
Right.
Whereas before, without this, if they defended themselves,
they wouldn't have the right to kill and keep the spoil.
They would have been guilty of murder or thievery.
Right. Right. Okay, that's
still
a good point.
Subject to the original decree. Here, they're not subject to the original decree after that first day.
Right. Okay, that's a good point. Meaning the others could cut, from the first decree, the others are allowed to try to kill the Jews. The Jews then could kill them back and would not be subject to any sort of crime in Persian law. Oh, that's a good point. I'll add a little more to that point in a minute, but I just want to read a few more verses here to put it all together. In verse 12, it says, upon one day in all the provinces of the king of Achashverosh, namely upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, that's referring to next Wednesday, the day we fast, and the fast of Esther, Tanis Esther, because that was the day where the decree was supposed to happen. The copy of the writing to be given out for the decree in every province was to be published unto all the peoples. The Jews should be ready against that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. So, again, the wording is not so exactly how everything was worded. We do see the king was giving the Jews the right to defend themselves and take the spoils. As we'll add a few points in over here. When we say they could take the spoils, if you read it later on in the Megillah, when they actually fought against enemies, they did not touch the spoils. It says, they didn't touch any of the spoils. But Achashverosh told them, or Mordechai wrote, you could take the spoils. So what was the point? So Rashi says that they didn't take the spoils because they wanted to show that we're fighting not for the money, we're fighting for our lives. We don't want to kill anybody. We're not interested in having a war. We're only doing it because, you know, we're threatened. But we don't want your money. We don't want to take anything. That's what Rashi points out. So then why did Mordechai write it into the letters? So the Vilna Gaon says that Mordechai was trying to encourage others to join the fight. I guess he wants the mercenaries to come in and take up the cause of the Jewish people. So when you write in there, anybody can legally take the spoils of the war, that's going to encourage others to join in the fight beyond the Jewish people. So that's what the Vilna Gaon writes. Another interesting point is made by the Ibn Ezra, another classic commentators in the Megillah. Way back in the beginning of Megillah, when Haman first sent out his letters. So many commentaries point out there was two different, what I'm called, versions of the letter. There was kind of one version that was reserved for the governors and officials of the land. And there was one that was more of a public decree. On the public letters, which they call the Pascheg and HaKesav, the public letters were just ones that said, be prepared for that day. You know, something's going to happen, you know, be prepared to, I don't know, to kill the Jews in that day. It was very, very vague, you know, kind of general statement. Then there was a more specific letter that was given to the governors of every single province, and they were told the details of the event. So when Mordechai sent out these second letters, he wrote also, Liyos ha-Yehudim asidim ha-yom hazeh. The Jews should be prepared for that day. To take revenge on their enemies. So Nebuchadnezzar Ezra writes that the way that Mordechai was trying to, you know, you weren't allowed to reverse the first decree, but Mordechai was trying to say, I'm not reversing the first decree, there's a typo in the first letters. That's what he writes. Because the first letter is when it says that what you should be prepared to kill. So the first letters may have said, you know, he says, Yahargu Yehudim. You know, they will kill the, or Yehudi, Yahargu. I mean, we're talking in Hebrew into Persian, I guess. But instead of saying to kill the Jews, the Jews should kill. I mean, two words got reversed in the letters, and really the first letter was all wrong. That's what trying to do. So that's what the Ibn Ezra writes. The Haman got it backwards when he first had the letters. The king's will was actually from the start that the Jews should not be killed by the enemies, they should kill their enemies. That was the point of the letters. So this was actually Mordechai's wisdom, Ibn Ezra writes, to be able to not just empower the Jews to fight back, but to try to show the Persians that first letter is actually a mistake. That's what he's trying to do. So, because you know, you have to look at the exact wording, it's unclear if this is a quote in Megillah, this is just a paraphrase. But the Ibn Ezra writes that Mordechai was trying to show that Mordechai essentially didn't want the Jews to have to fight a war and kill others. Mordechai wanted the Jews just to be protected. But he had to write, the Jews should kill, in order to say that first letter that says kill the Jews is actually just a typo, and it just said Jews should kill. That's what Ibn Ezra writes. But I think on a deeper level, so Ibn Ezra was saying that, that Mordechai was trying to show everybody it was the king's will the entire time that the Jews kill others, not that others kill the Jews. And on a deeper level, we know in the Megillah that the king always has double meaning. The king in the Megillah always refers to Ahasuerus and also the God, king of all kings. And the truth is, it was the king's will. It was God's will from the start that there should be a miracle and that we should be saved. So that first letter actually, you know, in a certain sense, was a typo. Because God never intended that we should be annihilated. God intended that we should be able to destroy our enemies. Just at that point, it seemed to be that they were going to kill us. So there is this concept of Mordechai trying to show that first letter was actually a mistaken letter, and the new letter is really the accurate one. Now, I don't know who bought that, who didn't buy that, but that was at least Mordechai trying to get his message across in a more effective way. We're out of time here. Let's do another verse or two left, and we'll pick up next week. But so the post that rode upon swift steeds were used in the king's service went out, being hastened and pressed on by the king's commandment, and the decree was given out in Shushan the castle. So again, it says that they rushed out at this point. Even though we waited 2 months to write the letters, once it was time to take the letters away, they rushed the letters out. And Mordechai went forth from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, with a great crown of gold, and with a robe of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan shouted and was glad. So Mordechai now goes out from the king's palace, and he's out in the royal garments, and Mordechai has taken the power in the kingdom. And Mordechai now is somebody who everybody sees and honors. I think that, so as we're late, we'll stop here, because I have a lot to add about these next few verses, so we'll probably hold this for next week. But God willing, next week we'll try to, I would like to be able to finish the Megillah next week if we can. We'll see how much time we have. We only have one more chapter after this, and a few more verses following that. So we'll see what we can do. But or else is always there. You can hang on to the copies if you want, or I can take them back for next week, whatever you want. Yeah, I'll keep them in my notebook for next week.